Badger Badge. Night gathers, and now our podcast begins. It shall not end until we're done talking. We are
the princes that were promised.
All right. Hello, hello, welcome to the princes that were promised, the wardens of Long Island. It's me, it's Shawnee Wan, and it's John on a Wednesday night, 3 days removed from
maybe the most overrated episode in my eyes. When I say overrated, my definition of mean overrated is I'm not saying something's not good. It's just not as good as the general populace believes it to be good.
No, it's really, really not. And what is it about this episode that people are, like, losing their minds over? There's people out there that have been watching the show that are saying, oh my God, it's the greatest episode ever. Clearly it's not.
Was better.
Yeah.
Passage was better. Winter Winter was far better. The Blackwater battle was better than this battle. And it was such a short battle, too. It wasn't even long. That's what, I mean, I like the battle in itself, but it just wasn't long enough in my eyes.
The Greyjoy Civil War at Sea battle. I'm not sure what to call that battle, but that battle I should have checked this out, but I think that battle was of equal length. I don't know if I could say it was as exciting when it was said and done. I felt a lot more fulfilled having watched that battle than this one. I was on the edge of my seat, probably more so with what they're calling... what they're calling this battle. We were calling it the Battle of the Supply Lines, which is a stupid fucking name for a battle. Matt Shackman and Benioff and Weiss are calling it the Loot Train Attack. I was on the edge of my seat the entire time, right? It was exciting visually. Visually, it was far and away. It was the best stuff that they've done on the series.
Oh, definitely. Drogon was fan fire at the way that fire was just coming down the ground and...
Yeah.
Just completely, I don't know what the word is, but like bellowing out from underneath and just like exploding, you know, like
right.
The ground.
I feel like the amount of money they dumped into Drogon and Dany in this episode alone, it has to be the sum of all their dragon effects thus far. And the visual of Dany on Drogon's back, I didn't think that they would be able to nail that the way they did. It looked amazing. Not only do I have no problem with the way they visualize Dany riding Drogon, but I think it's better than what I imagined based on the books. You get an image from an artist in the encyclopedia, and this was very reminiscent of those images. As a matter of fact, when I saw her, I guess it's weird to say this, but when I saw Dany riding on Drogon's back, it felt like Aegon the Conqueror. It felt like all the Targaryen dragon riders. And what I know of them, what I have stored in my head of what that must have looked like. And that just tapped right into it.
It fit.
It fit. It was flawless and it was perfect. And I'm just talking about Dany on Drogon's back and that special effect. Maybe that hit some other problems. I'm talking visually, not production-wise, not story-wise. But it was a little clanky on the Lannister side. I really couldn't get a good read on the number of Lannisters there were.
That wasn't a full army, that's why. Most of the army was already headed back to King's Landing with the gold.
Right. I'm just saying visually, it felt like in one wide shot of the majority of the Lannister army, I got a vibe that there were, say, 800, 900 guys. And then we get the shot with Dothraki, and it looked like there were, like, 100 guys. And then we get another shot, and it looked like there were, like, 2,000 guys. It was a little loosey-goosey on the Lannister side. And then with the Dothraki charging, it felt like their number doubled in one shot and then was a lot less in another shot. They're working in a timetable and they only have a certain number of days to get this battle wrapped up. At this point, you're treating these battles like Hollywood productions. If I'm going to have one complaint about the visual style of this battle, it's that the numbers, the amount of people on either side, I couldn't get a good grasp of what that was. Am I just making stuff up, or did you get that vibe at all?
I don't know. I think it's because they just didn't show like the army is in a full pan, like top or
right.
Full pan, so you couldn't really tell. But they probably got up shooting the same actress twice. So he got killed 2 seconds ago. He's back again. So there's another Lannister guy. You know, I probably just
he puts on the Bobby Valentine fake glasses and mustache, and he goes back out there. Yeah, that's beating up on it. I think, you know, that's being too hard on it. I mean, you could have solved it with a wide shot showing the true number that you have there, and then lined your shots up better, but. It worked. It definitely worked. That's pretty much our first topic today, is revisiting this battle. And I beat the crap out of it when last we spoke. I don't really feel like doing that again, but there is some reading that I did. Matt Shakman, who is a first-time director for Game of Thrones, which is funny that he would get a battle of this size his first time directing Game of Thrones. And he's an experienced TV director. But I feel like this is a battle that like Alan Taylor or Neil Marshall would have gotten. It's odd that they let a first-time Game of Thrones director handle a battle of this size.
What do you say this? Do you think they were holding back production and money because they still have a much bigger battle to come?
I was going to say that, yeah. Alan Taylor is returning this season, right? Or is it Neil Marshall? I'm sure he's got a more complicated battle, and that must be the case.
Might be the biggest battle they've ever done. You know what? I'm going to say something right now.
Sure.
That is why I think I'm disappointed in this episode. Because I was told, everyone was told, that this was be the biggest battle to date, was be the Field of Fire.
Well, in some ways it was. In terms of production, what did you mean by big? I'm sorry. What did you mean by big?
I meant like...
Like epic?
Just everything. Everything.
Like visually epic?
Yeah.
It wasn't. I think the Battle of the Bastards was far more epic.
The wall was better. It was a more epic battle.
Would you think that this battle was more epic if it was a better constructed battle, story-wise? Would that make it epic, or was it other problems that you had with this battle?
I just don't think it was long enough. I really don't think it was long enough to be considered a great battle. It felt like 7 minutes long.
I'm sure part of the reason for that is the cost of the dragon. And if they have a bigger battle coming down the pike, which I'm sure they do, and I'm sure it does involve a dragon, or two, or three, they're going to cut a little bit of the budget for this battle and put it more towards that battle. They must think what they put on film, what they edited together as the final battle sequence, they must think that they had a winner. And a lot of people do think that they had a winner. But the time is weird because it's the shortest episode in Game of Thrones history. So right. Yeah, why cut time out of it? Why not add a few more minutes? There were parts of this battle that were great. Dany on Drogon was amazing. And the bronze sequence, where he drops the gold and then he needs to get to the scorpion and he shoots that guy with the scorpion and then he reloads it up, and that was some tense stuff. The whole battle was on the edge of my seat. Battle of the Bastards, I have to say. I want to say I was more on the edge of my seat. But that's because there's so much emotion in that battle. And that wasn't the case here. When you start listing the Game of Thrones battles and you say Blackwater, the Battle of the Wall, Battle of the Bastards, can you put the Loot Train attack in that category?
No. It's a good battle. I don't know. It's like, I think I'm getting a headache right now. I'm just trying to like, I don't want to bash it. It was a good battle, but I think it just left a lot to be desired, especially in the fact that it was such a short episode where they could have, you know, added some more stuff in there. You know, yeah. They could have added a lot more.
Maybe on paper, this battle was not as epic as they've made it out to be. And perhaps they try to add so much stuff and make it so visually exciting that it just doesn't work. Because ultimately, it's a skirmish. Had Jaime died, you know, the commander of the Lannister army, okay, then it's an important battle.
But that's what someone said, too. Like, no one died in this battle. I mean, you can say maybe the Battle of Bastards, no, the good guys really died. Really, you know, I'm like, no, you know, the main good guys really died.
No, but there were already stakes there.
Jamie is not dying. I don't like how they did that. Like, try to make you suspect, oh my god, Jamie might die. Please.
No, there's no way.
Bronn isn't dead. I mean, did they even show the Tarleys? Did they get killed? They didn't even show the Tarleys get killed. So maybe, are they still alive? Like, no one died in this.
But even if the Tarleys die, like, all right, you know, what, we've known them for a few episodes.
Right.
I'm not even talking about death. The stakes as far as Battle of the Bastards, they were fighting for Winterfell, and that was their one shot at getting it back. The emotional investment was built in. This wasn't like a buildup of storylines. This was a skirmish. This was like an opening battle. And I think maybe, now that we're talking about it, that's what's wrong with it. This battle would have been a lot better if Jaime went back to King's Landing and said, Bronn, you wrap things up here, and Jaime's not even there. And maybe she doesn't even attack with Drogon. I mean, had it just been the Dothraki attacking and Bronn leading the Lannisters, or she attacks with the dragon and no Dothraki, and it's a small Lannister force, and Bronn's racing trying to get to the scorpion, he survives. That would be great. Same amount of time, less of a big production, a big hootie-hoo about this thing, and I'd be okay with it. Maybe it was smaller originally on paper. It's an opening skirmish. They tried to turn an opening skirmish into an epic battle. You need to save those epic battles for storylines that are coming to a head. But it'd be like if you had Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels, the 60-minute Iron Man match on Monday Night Raw. It was too big for that episode. It was too big for this point in the series. It was too big for where we are in these storylines. It was like a big crescendo when we didn't build up to it. Matt Shackman, he was trying to keep it focused on Jamie Lannister, and he was trying to go for a Steven Spielberg Saving Private Ryan feel.
Here's my now the fact that you're raising even more questions I have. Let me say that maybe it's not that the battle was bad. It's not it wasn't long enough. I think it just raises too many questions. Mm-hmm. I raised some the other night. How come Danny didn't take three dragons? How come they didn't go for the scorpion right away? Like they knew like those arrows were going to do something. Come on,
yeah.
Firing from men 80 feet below. It just so happens to be that Jimmy Lannister and his army took the scorpion with them. I mean, I guess it's easy to answer this, but it just feels
okay.
Convenient.
Okay, yeah. You know what I'm saying? You're
like,
right.
It's an easy answer. Like, oh, they were prepared. They thought they would definitely be able to find a dragon, possibly.
It's an easy answer after the question's been asked. After the decision's been made to include the scorpion. Okay, all right, you're on. It's like this battle was constructed backwards. They wanted to come up with a reason to include this battle. This battle doesn't fit at this point in the story, but they wanted to put it there. Why do they have the scorpion? Is there just one scorpion? Does every Lannister
contingency have a scorpion?
Right. Are there scorpions set up all over King's Landing? The way that Qyburn presented that scorpion to Cersei kind of seems like that's the only scorpion in King's Landing. I didn't see any other scorpions in that room, right?
They didn't appear like it was.
I think I talked about this when Qyburn showed her the scorpion. This is another part of our seven-pointed star tonight, is the scorpions versus the dragon. For the sake of time, for the sake of it making sense, because I'm sure we'll come back to this battle, but yeah, scorpion can kill the dragon. A scorpion killed Meraxes. I was trying to find out which dragons were killed by enemies that weren't riding dragons. Because when you think of the Dance of the Dragons, the Targaryen Civil War, that pretty much wiped out all of the remaining dragons. There were dragons on either side, and they were killing each other. Usually a dragon is killed by another dragon, but in the case of Meraxes, who's one of the like Hall of Fame Targaryen dragons, he was killed by a bolt to the eye. It was at Hellholt, down by Dorne, Queen Rhaenys. She was trying to retake Sunspear, and I guess Sunspear had declared for, I think it was King Joffrey at that point, or acting King Joffrey Targaryen. I forget, I should have read up the Dance of the Dragons, but she was trying to retake Sunspear. A bolt from a scorpion pierced the eye of Meraxes, and the dragon and the queen fell from the sky. In her death throes, the dragon destroyed the castle's highest tower and part of the curtain wall. Queen Rhaeny's body was never returned to King's Landing. So it can be done. A scorpion can kill a dragon, but it seems like it's not something that happened a whole lot.
Yeah, we had to get a good shot on that group this week.
Right.
They got the shot on the wing, and he thought it was going to go down, and it didn't go down. Like, you got to get a good shot.
And just the likelihood of getting that shot, because the dragon's flying and moving, and like it's a good weapon against dragons, but I feel like you need quite a few of them to really be successful. Yeah, maybe the scorpions just weren't explained well enough or presented as this, like a dragon buster. It's not really the case at all. It was still exciting, that whole sequence with Bronn running to the scorpion. It was, and I might be wrong, but it was a more simple opening skirmish, and they added on all these extra parts to make it buzzworthy, to make it talked about, to make it more exciting. And it was, we said, visually exciting, edge of our seats, but at the end, it feels like you had a meal of like a Snickers bar where it tastes good and it kind of fills you up, but you kind of feel shitty afterwards. You're not really fulfilled. Whereas Battle of the Bastards, you were in that battle. You were nervous when that battle was about to start. You didn't think you could win that battle, but you're in there with Jon Snow. The same thing that Matt Shackman was going for. Shit, what's the director's name, man? We love this guy. Something like Latino, maybe, or...
It's, hold on.
Yeah, I gotta look it up. I can't let this one go. Miguel.
Sapochnik.
Yeah, Miguel Sapochnik.
Well, yeah, what'd you say the name? That's all he needed was the first name.
Yeah, I kept thinking Mark Mylod, but it wasn't him. But yeah, Miguel Sapochnik did the same thing that Matt Shackman was going for. Better. It worked because you had so much more time with that battle. You were in there with John. You've been with John the whole time, and now it's like culminating with this battle. Whereas this thing...
Let me ask you a question. Some of that being pinpointed on the fact that with this Field of Fire battle, let's call it that. I'm not calling it the whatever. That's stupid in my eyes.
Oh, the loot train attack?
The loot train fight. You know? I think it's because they try to do it through Jamie's point of view, through Jamie's personal struggle, and it just doesn't work because... I don't know. It just doesn't work.
You're right. Yeah, I think that was a problem approaching it from that way. It was well thought out, but it doesn't work because you're not just following Jaime. You're in there with Daenerys, and I understand one of the best parts of the battle was where Bronn starts to hear the rumbling, and you see the Dothraki, and then you see the dragon, and you get a little bit of that Daenerys Targaryen music. You don't want to get that from Dany's point of view. You want to get it from Jaime's point of view or the Lannister point of view where the dragon suddenly comes out of nowhere and you get that feeling of fear and awe at the same time. But then sticking with Jaime, I guess he wanted to do that to lead up to that end charge by Jaime. Mm. But you also have to follow Bronn and you also have to stick with Daenerys. So it didn't work. He had a plan of attack and he followed through for the most part. So I'll give him an A for effort. I think it's just the scope of this battle was too much for the time they had, the point where they were in the story.
We get a panning towards his files. It's like, yeah, we all know where the last army is going to be at that time.
The technical parts of it, too. These are the things that weren't thought out. There are too many letdowns because there's too many ideas in this battle, too short amount of time, and no stakes were raised. You could have still got most of the best parts of that battle in a different way. Save the Dothraki. Save that for another episode.
She could go on the Dragon by herself.
No, but at the same time, like, that's not the whole Lannister army, and I felt like that was all of the force that Daenerys has at this point, right? With no Tyrells, no Martells, no Greyjoys, no Unsullied. It's just the Dothraki and the dragons. Two of which she left at home. Would Daenerys bring her entire army for a small part of the Lannisters? That doesn't even make sense. The closer you look at this thing, the more irritating it is, the less it works.
I think it should be bigger in scope.
But then you need to commit most of that episode to this battle and the lead into it. It can't just be an add-on thing at the end of the episode, which is what they did with it. I don't know if you said this on air or off air, but take out that stupid Brienne Arya scene and add that on to the running time for this battle or the lead up to this battle. I could agree with that. What would you have done differently? How would you have written this? How would you have produced this? Would you have had a death?
What? Who are you going to kill? I mean, as you said, the Tarleys, but...
But that's like expected. Like, that's like, you know...
Yeah, like...
I would have killed Bronn, honestly. I would have killed Bronn.
Yeah.
Not that I want to, but I'm sure we're going to get quite a few deaths that I don't want to get. Because then you do start to raise the stakes. You kill a fan favorite like Bronn?
Like for the battle of the wall... D&D was saying that we had to kill Pip and Grimm because we needed some death in there. We needed John to feel lost. We needed the viewers to feel that there is loss in these battles.
And that's the stakes that I'm talking about. I like Grimm, I like Pip, but I had no complaint about it. They can't kill Sam. Can't kill Dolorous Ed. Did you have a problem with them dying?
I was like, oh, shit. I wasn't like...
But immediately it raises the stakes of the battle. It hits home. It gets you in the gut. And that's what Bronn's death would have done. It just makes you think they're all bulletproof. And that last, the final part of the whole sequence.
Let's pull it back a second, man. Let's not say all for the just yet.
Okay.
Maybe we gotta wait until next week and see what comes out of this. There has to be payoff from this.
You're right.
We didn't get death, so there's gotta be a payoff somehow. There's gotta be some sort of reason for this.
Okay. You're right, because I have busted Weiss and Benioff's chops before, saying there's no reason for this, it's going nowhere, and then they do return to it, and it does make sense. They haven't failed me yet, so I don't know why I think that they would this time. Be patient with it. I can't say it was all for nothing, but it was still disappointing.
I'm going to stop the discussion right now. An impromptu thing here. I'm watching here on... Hold on, let me get it again. Supposedly, fans have spotted a mysterious woman in the Bran Arya scene.
What?
Yes. They're saying it could be Catelyn.
Shut up.
It's very creepy. She's just, you see her, you see the shot, and it's, you know, Podrick's on the left, Brienne's back to us, and Arya's, like, looking at us, like, you know, we'll be with space in our direction. And there's a, you know, gateway, and then across the gateway, there's a woman which appears to be walking across in a hooded outfit.
Are you watching this on, you're on YouTube?
Yeah, no, it's not on YouTube. I just saw it on Facebook. I clicked the link. HuffingtonPost.com. Supposedly the woman appears twice. It just has to be something. They just had to put some sort of extra credit, you know, they had to. She's not tall enough to be Catelyn. Are you watching?
Well, I'm trying to find it on YouTube.
I mean, definitely not. It's just funny though.
Oh, you don't think it's not her?
Well, it has to be. It just has to be someone walking across. It's like, yeah, we need an extra in the back to make it a little like so unrealistic as that these five people aren't the only people in Winterfell right now. I'm reading the comments. They're like, stop the presses. There's a redheaded girl in the north. But real quick too before. Did you get that meme I sent you? Where it was Robert Baratheon, only a fool would meet the Dothraki at open field. And then it's a picture of Jimmy Lannister. Oh, might be her.
Yeah. Only a fool would meet the Dothraki in the open field. Oh, my beer.
Don't do it, you idiot.
Say what you will about Robert, but he's not backing down from anybody in battle.
Well, it was a picture of Jamie saying, oh, my beer.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm looking at it now, but... But Robert, to say only a fool would meet the Dothraki, he is one of the fools that would do it, is Robert. Matter of fact, why don't we move on and talk about the Dothraki for a moment? We'll put this down as number 3 on our 7-pointed star for the spoils of war. That being the Dothraki military style versus that of the noble houses of Westeros. And it's a numbers game, man. It reminds me almost of cowboys and Indians. Native American Indians are really a good comparison to Dothraki. Riding from horseback, shooting bows and arrows. And we really get that visual. All this talk that we've heard and read about can how great they are at riding and how they can shoot arrows like nobody's business from horseback.
I love the scene where they jump up on the horse.
It was awesome.
That was actually probably my favorite part of that battle, I think.
Well, I mean, it was one of those great parts of the battle. It was like a bunch of really visually appealing sequences put together, and that was one of them. It was awesome, because you heard about it. Like with Danny on our Dragon, you heard about Dragon Riders, and now you see it, and it meets your expectation. You heard about how well the Dothraki can ride, and the damage they can do in a battle from horseback, and then you see it. And they have that one charge, that initial charge. Unless they have equal or greater numbers, which they had here, they had greater numbers, right? They were far more Dothraki than Lannisters here, I think, in this battle.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I definitely feel like what I kind of want to talk about was the fighting style of Dothraki was definitely something that the Lannister army was not prepared for. Like, I don't think they really ever went against an army like that. I mean, I think the Lannister army is probably the best trained army there is in Westeros right now.
That's a dangerous statement because I agree with you. They are, but it's not that same army. These are all newer recruits. I talked about this last week.
Well, how do you know they're newer recruits?
Because not going off of Song of Ice and Fire, I know it was mentioned it had to be season 4. It was one of Tywin and Lady Olenna's conversations about the Lannisters running out of gold and the Lannisters running out of men because they'd been fighting in the War of the Five Kings. Their entire host... So that's basically the entirety of their army was split between Jaime and Tywin at the outset of the War of the Five Kings. And Jaime's was shot to shit. And then Tywin's was in battle after battle, Battle of the Blackwater. And that's why Sir Stafford had to raise a host at Casterly Rock, which is something they also adapted for Game of Thrones. And Robb came upon them following Grey Wind through a goat trail or a sheep trail or something and snuck up on them. And took them out. And that's something that also happened in Game of Thrones because that was the reason that Joffrey was having Ser Meryn Trant give Sansa the body blows. Just based on that, maybe it's not a situation where they're running low on men, but it's an army that it's definitely not a veteran army. It's not nearly as experienced an army as the one that Tywin marched to the Riverlands at the outset of the War of the Five Kings. Maybe it doesn't mean anything. Maybe it doesn't.
Well, you're looking at it as the book perspective. I'm looking at it as the perspective where lashes lose 10,000 men. Don't worry, next episode, they restock with 40,000 more.
It's like for every Lannister army guy you kill, you get four more.
Five more.
Yeah, they just pop up. Yeah, you can let it go. And yeah, that Lannister winning tradition, even if Tywin's gone, it's still there. So yeah, they probably are the most knowledgeable, the best trained. But even so, even if they are, they've never done battle with the Dothraki. Unless there's a member of the Lannister army who served in the free companies across the Narrow Sea in Essos, they probably have the most experience with Dothraki. But no Westerosi knights have fought Dothraki. It's like they have a scouting report on the Dothraki.
Yeah, but it's like you go up against like a run and shoot offense. You get a scouting report, but once you see it and you have to defend against five receivers every day, it's a little tougher to prepare against, especially when, you know,
on paper you can write down a solid defense. But sticking to that in the chaos, as they're keeping you off balance, it's a lot harder. So Jamie could be like, all right, guys, remember, watch out for when they stand up on their horses and shoot arrows. You know, be sure to, like, hold your shields up high and you'll be fine. It's like, all right. And then you see, like, 10,000 of them doing it. You're like, what the fuck? I'm out of here.
All right, guys, prepare yourselves for the dominant initiative.
Yeah. You can't prepare for that. Scouting report at best, you have an idea of what's coming at you. But once you see it, it's like, holy shit. Dothraki in an open field. It's incredible. And Jorah even says so. I think it's in the first season. He comments at how great Westerosi knights are, their armor, their steel. And he used to think that nothing could beat, I'm totally going to be paraphrasing what he says in a bad way, but columns of Westerosi men-at-arms, shields up, spears out, ready for a charge. He used to think nothing could get past that until he saw the Dothraki in action. Then he wasn't so sure. I think in a situation like we saw in the Spoils of War, yeah, the Dothraki are going to win that battle. But if Westeros has the numbers on them, it's that initial charge. And then it's a bunch of guys with armor fighting a bunch of guys without armor. And I think back to that Barristan Selmy chapter in The Dance with Dragons where he's fighting a Dothraki in his Dar Zolorex chamber when he goes to arrest his Dar and he says, and that the pit fighter comes at him. Got no armor, and he's like, I'm going to kill you, old man. And Barristan's like, oh, shit, he says the best line. It's like, then come for me, said Barristan the Bold. And the guy came for him, and he couldn't get a shot because he's wearing fucking armor. You know, and he's letting the guy hack at him and whatever. He goes and slashes the fucking guy's head off.
Well, it's like kind of like in season one, like the Jorah fight also.
Yeah, perfect, yes. Jorah had the armor. So, yeah, the guy was maybe a better fighter. He's faster. He doesn't have the armor. At the end of the day, it is a lot like cowboys versus Indians. They know the land, they're quiet, they're fast, but the cowboys got guns. So maybe six Indians could take out two cowboys, but six cowboys are definitely going to take out six Indians because they got fucking guns, dude. Westeros has armor and better steel. So ultimately, they're going to win.
You would think, but you know, who knows?
Yeah. You know, if they keep doing this, if they do like, you know, guerrilla-style warfare, be better served, but all the Dothraki, what are they going to, like, charge at King's Landing? They're not going to get in. I think that a mind like Tywin Lannister would be able to concoct a plan to defeat the Dothraki. And I think that Qyburn given enough time, Randall Tarly given enough time, Jaime given enough time, they could figure out a way to defeat the Dothraki. It'd have to be a plan, and they'd have to be ready for it. But the Dothraki combined with the dragons, that's a different story. But that was really cool, man. That charge was great. Something that was put in our head way back in season one. And we finally get the payoff. It was worth the wait. It was really good to see. And I hope we see more of it. I'm sure we'll see more of it. So going back to that question you had before, I think it was off air.
Oh, do you think that the Dothraki are going to be fighting in the war for the Dawn?
Right.
If they do, I hope we they put some clothes on these guys because the cold will kill them before the freaking goddamn White Walk as well.
Queen Daenerys, why didn't you tell us that it was going to be colder over here? Our children are freezing. Like, it's snowing over here.
It would be really funny if they go into battle with no clothes on. It tells me they would go with the right way. They're not going to have any clothes on. You know, they'll have their normal
Benioff and Weiss are talking, they're like, oh shit, like, we got the Dothraki up here, but like, we don't have any fucking costumes for them that look like coats. So like, we could either make a bunch.
We already had an episode where, like, you know, we show people dying from, you know,
from the cold.
From the cold.
We're making,
we're just gonna throw these guys out there.
And winter has to be bad. I mean, the Starks keep saying winter is coming, so it can't be like a light dusting. So it's either we have the Dothraki up there with no shirts on, or we make them a bunch of costumes, but we'll probably have to cut a dragon out of the budget. Oh, man. I'm sure they'll figure it out either way, but do I see the Dothraki fighting for the Battle of the Dawn? I do.
You have to, right?
Yeah.
They need numbers.
If nothing else, the spirit of Khal Drogo. Khal Drogo. Not Ivan Drago. But the spirit of Khal Drogo, him being there with Daenerys in spirit through his people.
Speaking of numbers, we can go on to our number four topic.
Right.
Cersei Lannister once again reamping the army, getting the Golden Company.
The Golden Company. I didn't even think of this when I was watching the episode, and you caught me stunned because I didn't even pick up on it. I mean, I did. I heard him say Golden Company. I heard her say Golden Company. They talked about the Golden Company the week before, I believe, too, right?
I'm not sure. I can't remember.
It was mentioned at another point this season, the Golden Company.
It was mentioned a few years ago, too, with Stannis.
Yeah.
And Davos. They were told they should get the Golden Company.
Yeah. The problematic part for me, which I mentioned in our instant review, is that the Golden Company is so closely associated with the Blackfyres, the bastards of House Targaryen.
I have two answers for that. One is, goes hand in hand with what I said on the instant review, I think, that they're just giving the Golden Company to Cersei's army.
Right.
And that, I believe I've been saying it a couple of times, that in the show, you're going to get some Fagin storyline with Cersei. And this is just going to be another way of them doing that and showing that.
Okay.
And they're not going to have Fagin, but we're going to give some of his plot line and storyline to Cersei's. You're going to the fact that the Golden Company is always sided with the Blackfyre.
It's so closely entwined with Blackfyre history.
Right. In a way, the show could be doing that with Cersei if Cersei is a bastard Targaryen.
You said that in the instant review, and I was thinking about that this week. It's possible to pull that off. I think I said during the instant review that there's not enough time left for that to be a storyline. But there is. There's definitely a way they could work it in. I keep saying this issue of time because I think you also brought up Aegon last week and the possibility of Aegon still being included. I don't think that's the case, but as far as time, I think I'm wrong, because six episodes in 2019 and the rumor mill strongly suggesting that they're all feature-length film episodes. So hour 20 minutes, hour and a half. You look at it that way, that's like a 9-episode season. So you can fit Aegon in.
It's too late, though. They would have done it
already. Yeah, I agree with you, but it's possible.
In the books, dude, in the books, Cersei's not sitting the throne in the books. I think it's Fagin. I think that's
right.
A villainous obstacle for Dany when she gets over to Westeros.
I mean, it makes the most sense.
It's a big leap. For Cersei to think that she can claim to be a queen of Westeros. I mean, if anything, Jaime's actually the rightful king with their standpoint. You know what I'm saying? Like, Jaime would come before Cersei.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Let's follow that for a second, because that's fucking interesting. Is Cersei, was she the heir to the Iron Throne after Tommen jumped out the window? Because Jaime wasn't in the Kingsguard.
No, he's out of the Kingsguard right now. Yeah, he was.
At that point, when he jumped out the window, he was out of the Kingsguard by then.
Yes. Yep. Someone made a, I don't know, I saw it, but they follow the laws of succession, and since there are no Baratheons left, Baratheon, I say that loosely, you know, Joffrey, Tom, and Marcella.
Right.
That it then would go, the kingship then would go to the hand.
Oh, wow.
Or something, or the hand of the king, or his offspring. I have no idea.
Okay.
Westerosi law would mean male or female, that Jaime, being outside the King's Guard, not in the King's Guard anymore, that Jaime would then actually be the one to sit the Iron Throne.
Because the hand at that point in time was Sir Kevin, was it not?
Right. I was actually thinking Tywin, but obviously it wasn't Tywin. Maybe this guy was wrong.
Wait, was it Sir Kevin? No, Sir Kevin was protector of the realm. Wasn't Mace Tyrell? No, they didn't give it to Mace Tyrell in the show because he's a fucking dolt. He's a fucking moron. In A Song of Ice and Fire, Mace Tyrell is the hand to the king. And
all right, so that basically just forget right there and just said right there.
Well, no, but that's in A Song of Ice and Fire. In Game of Thrones, it's not Mace Tyrell. It's Kevin Lannister, if I remember correctly. Because of the character that they made Mace Tyrell out to be. That's fucking interesting. That's very interesting. Cersei, I think it's Cersei, right? Yes. Is it? Cersei's older than Jaime. She was the first one out.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter because they're in Westeros.
That's what she said.
Yeah. So you're not going to make any more "that's what she said" jokes. You're never going to say that again. Nope. Well, that is hard. I mean, you always left me satisfied. That's what she said.
I love Packer. Packer just gives him like the little like nod to do it.
Yeah.
Well, he always left me satisfied. It's smiling. That's really funny. You think you last all night?
Oh, man. There's no clear answer to this, bro. Tommen has no heir. Well, Tommen does have an heir in Margaery, but Margaery dies. That was the beauty of Cersei's plan. Gets rid of all her enemies and makes herself the heir to the Iron Throne.
But then, like, in a way, how could she jump over Jaime then? You know what I'm saying? Like that, it just goes back to, you know, she's jumping over Jaime then.
Jaime's never had any interest in ruling.
Well, I guess it's also true, I guess, because although she never took the Baratheon name, she feels that since she married the king at one point, then she's next in line. I guess that's where she gets it all from.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it is.
And it's a hazy enough situation where she's got the most credibility to be the queen of the Seven Kingdoms at that point in time. If you look at legal Westerosi rule, Jaime could definitely make a case against her, and I'm sure he could rally enough support, but it would be a Lannister civil war because Cersei's not going to give that up. And I think Jaime knows that, and he's not interested in it. I doubt it even crossed his mind. Although, would it be interesting? No, it wouldn't be interesting. I was going to say, would it be interesting if Jaime is still with Cersei, and then she dies, and he becomes king of Westeros involved in this war, but I don't, that's not going to happen. Far more interesting if he has it up to here with her, and he leaves her side while she's still ruling. Back to the Golden Company.
They were with you, the Golden Company, all right.
Yeah, the Blackfyres, the Targaryen Great Bastards. To Aegon IV, who was Aegon the Unworthy, who all maesters and scholars of Westeros agree was just about the worst king in the history of Westeros. Daemon Waters, Aegor Rivers, Maia Rivers, Gwenny's Rivers, and then you have Brynden Rivers and Shiera Seastar. Maia Rivers, Gwenny's Rivers, those two girls don't really do anything of note, but the other four, Daemon Waters, Daemon the First Blackfyre, he had some kind of pirate king title. But as Aegor Rivers, who is known as Bittersteel, he founds the Golden Company after his failed bid to get Daemon on the Iron Throne. He retreats to Essos, but the plan is to return to Westeros and win the Iron Throne. Brynden Rivers is a great bastard, but he sides with the Targaryen. And Shiera Seastar is their half-sister, who they're both madly in love with, and it's said that she is a sorceress, Shiera Seastar. It's really, really interesting, the great bastards of Aegon IV. So to go into the Golden Company, just to water that down, I feel like it's something that is going to upset book fans. This can't be something that Benioff and Weiss are doing as a fan service. Just the name, the Golden Company, just so people are like, oh, all right, cool. Because
I guess what they're doing.
Well, no, what I'm saying is, if they're going to do it, there's a reason they're going to do it, and it's going to be the way that they do it. Brynden Rivers, as far as I know, doesn't exist in this universe. We got to go back to the Three-Eyed Raven. Why not make him Brynden Rivers? Then you have to give this backstory that may or may not make sense to people watching TV. It's just going to add more confusion to an already somewhat confusing plot. Okay, fine. But then on the back end, you're going to include the Golden Company, and you can't really include Aegor Rivers if you're not going to include Brynden Rivers, because the reason that Aegor Rivers was unsuccessful is because of Brynden Rivers. Going to the Golden Company, founded by Aegor Rivers, who called himself Bittersteel, legitimized bastard of King Aegon IV Targaryen. He fled Westeros with the younger sons of Daemon Blackfyre at the end of the Blackfyre Rebellion. And it's said now to be made up of exiles and the sons of exiles. Shit, man. I should know this, but didn't Jorah Mormont serve with the Golden Company?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, I think it was the Golden Company he served with. But after Aegor is dead and gone, Maelys the Monstrous, who is the last of the Blackfyres to make a claim at the throne, he heads the Golden Company. Sir Barristan Selmy kills Maelys in the War of the Nine Penny Kings, which was really like the last real Blackfyre threat. Golden Company are considered the largest and the most expensive sellsword company in the Free Cities. Their motto is, "Our word is as good as gold." And their war cry is, and I love this quote, I don't know why, but I love this quote, "Beneath the gold, the bitter steel." Pays homage to Aegor Rivers. Mm. They're far more organized than most any host that a noble Westeros house can come up with. They reward their men handsomely. 10,000 men in the Golden Company, several thousand horses, elephants, 500 knights, each having 3 horses, 500 squires, each having 1 horse, 1,000 archers. Miles Twain is a captain general that John Connington was friendly with, who he planned John Connington's invasion of Westeros with. But he dies and Harry Strickland takes over and he's pretty much a coward. So all that being said, how do you involve this in Game of Thrones? Do you include Harry Strickland? Are they just guys that show up and start fighting? Do you have elephants?
Just guys that show up and start fighting.
You think so?
Yeah. Another way of them getting another army for the Lannisters.
Maybe it will sit better with me. It's just not sitting with me right now because I feel they could use another sellsword company like the Second Son. Well, no, we talked about this last week too. The Second Sons is the one they used for fucking what's-his-face when he was really in the Windblown.
But they could always have him come back and betray Danny. Darian Horus.
Now that would be more interesting, no?
I would find that interesting, yes.
Unless they are going to reveal Cersei as a Blackfyre, I don't think they're going to use the Blackfyre heritage with the Golden Company. They're in it for the final third of A Song of Ice and Fire. They're in it. So I guess you're right. If you're going to include them, it's Cersei taking that Aegon storyline, condensing things, moving things around like a puzzle. I just think the Golden Company is a very, very interesting component, and to see it watered down with all the other things that get watered down, it's disappointing.
You're looking at too much of a book reader right now. They're using it.
Yeah.
They're using it just to get on the army and a call back to the fans after you read the book. Say, look, we are going to introduce the Golden Company.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what else do you have to say about the Golden Company?
I think you pretty much covered it, I think.
Yeah. So would this be something you think that shows up this season?
Well, I don't want to talk about spoilers. I don't think it'll show up this season, but there is an interesting way how they are going to get introduced.
Okay.
I think that happens in episode 7.
Let's do Brienne and Arya right now, because all I wanted to touch on this was, how would you have made that different, John? What would you have done?
Not even filmed it.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to go.
The best way to do it real quick, the best way, if you wanted to show Arya, like, you know, as a badass, you could have done that, and you could have shown Brienne as she was in her initial, like, not giving it too much thought.
Right.
And you could have had Arya, like, having the upper hand.
Okay.
But then you just have to show, okay, Brienne's like, all right, hold on, let me roll the sleeves up here. This is going to be much harder, you know,
yeah,
than I thought it was going to be. And with my weight and size compared to Arya, I'm going to overpower her, and that's what she does. And I think if you go, even if they had maybe one slight change, and this is what I was thinking about, even if they made one slight change, you could have at least explained this a lot better. You could have made it flow a lot better between the two components. When Brienne does kick Arya down, Arya should stay down, and when she gets up, she should get up slowly. Instead, she does this, like, tilt the wall, you know.
Shawn Michaels kip up.
There you go.
Yeah.
As if, like, nothing fazed her. As if it was a WWE kick out.
Yeah.
You know? As if you got the 1-2, then all of a sudden, oh, God, he kicked out. Yeah. Oh, boy. It just made no, she would have gone up really slow, like, holding her stomach or her chest area wherever she got kicked. Then at least you show Brienne's power. You show that Arya, as good as she may learn, pick up for a lack of size. Instead, all of a sudden, it's like, you know, big jump, you know, Brienne being like, oh my God. It's just, I'm sorry. The people out there actually thought that was a great scene.
Dude, people are bugging about this episode. They think everything about it is just like the most amazing stuff. It's not. This one in particular. It's unnecessary.
You know what? I'm going to say something right now. If this scene wasn't in there, I would like the battle. I would, even if you didn't make the battle longer, it was still the same amount of time.
Yeah.
I would have liked the battle a lot better. I would have liked the episode a lot better. But this just soured me so much. It just soured me.
It's interesting when you say you would have liked the battle better. Is it because?
I think I was aggravated watching the battle. Because I just could not get over it. I just could not. You can't tell me that Brienne is not overpowering Arya. I mean, yeah, Brienne, okay. She got trained by, you know, what's his name?
Brienne?
No, Arya.
Arya. Yeah, Cyril Ferrell. So what? That was, like, you know, so long ago. And she wasn't that good then.
She got her ass kicked by the witch. She got her ass kicked by freaking Balor. She's like this like unstoppable warrior. You make it Brienne have to be like this, like you, who you've had Brienne beat up the Hound.
Right.
So basically you're telling me it's Brienne. Basically you're telling me Arya can defeat the Hound in one-on-one combat. But not happening.
Arya could defeat everybody in Westeros, it looks like. And fuck, man, if Cyril Farrell was that good of a teacher, and if Cyril Farrell is the reason she can do that right now, why the fuck didn't she save Ned? Why didn't she use those skills to save Ned? If that's all the stuff she learned from Cyril Farrell. Like, her training had to continue for that scene to work. I know she hid Needle away, so she wasn't practicing with Needle for quite some time while she was at the House of Black and White. And if she was, you know, that training she had with the Waif, she didn't look that good while she was training with the Waif. The Waif wasn't even that good. Fucking Waif, dude. I hate the Waif. It's almost like Benioff and Weiss are protecting Arya. I got nothing to say on it. I mean, you've captured my feelings on it. I think a simple conversation between the two of them would have been much more satisfying. Tyrion Lannister. We talked about how odd it was that he was even at that battle. And again, having the discussion we had tonight about that battle, it feels like he was another part that was just added on to make it more interesting.
How did he show up there?
Yeah. How did he show up there? How did they show up at the same time? They must have had like a big head start from Daenerys. She's like, all right, you guys go ahead. I'm going to wait like 3 sundowns and then I'm going to ride my dragon. And we should arrive there just in time if our spies are correct with where that small part of the Lannister army is right now. It was weird that he was there. That being said, the reason for him to be there, to watch Jaime charging at Daenerys and to see the... Would you say it was a conflicted look on his face?
Yes. Yeah, he was sad for the Lannister army. He was, you know, because... And he grew up with a lot of those guys.
Right.
And he knew the destruction that that dragon could do.
So what kind of picture does that paint of Tyrion? Is he a traitor? Can you make a case that he's a traitor?
No, but he made the case that he's going to be conflicted now. Maybe conflicted in a way that he didn't think he would be conflicted.
That's a tough spot for him, man. You know, the situations that brought him to Daenerys, the anger leaving King's Landing, but having had time away, having a successful run, a mostly successful run in Meereen with Daenerys, I think it took his mind away from the anger that he had for Cersei. It's still there. He still hates her. But now upon return and actually seeing this stuff that he was planning for, I'm sure he thought about Jaime. He thought about his friend Bronn, all these Lannister military men that he knew. I'm sure he thought of them planning this attack on Casterly Rock and planning the invasion of Westeros. But again, it goes back to what we were talking about with the Dothraki. Getting a scouting report, knowing what they can do, but then actually seeing it. So him actually seeing the Lannisters losing, Lannisters getting burned by Dragonfire and cut down by Dothraki, and his brother, a suicide run at a dragon, what does he do from here? Does he just press on? The aftermath of this battle will be interesting to see.
Definitely. That's what I'm looking for to next week. Hopefully that's something that comes out of this battle.
The spoilers you've read, I don't want to know what happens, but is it, maybe you don't know, but is it interesting what happens next week pertaining to the aftermath of this battle? Or were the spoilers not that in-depth?
It's interesting.
Okay.
I think it just depends on how some people take the news. Oh my god. Oh my god. Hold on. I'm reading my Twitter right now.
What happened?
Oh my god. Winter is coming. Diamond, I guess, is reporting. Spoils of War Director Matt Shackman will not return for Game of Thrones Season 8. I'd say he left his mark.
I can't knock Matt Shackman for that episode. That's not him. That's Benioff and Weiss. You know, look, the pacing of that episode, the performance, and this will be the last segment we talk about with the Stark kids, but I thought it was directed very well. It was the editing and the writing and the overall direction of the storylines that didn't work for me. You know, every scene I was fully engaged in. I couldn't look away. That's not Matt Shackman's fault. But you heard it here first. Breaking news on The Princes That Were Promised. Matt Shackman will not return for Season 8. Tyrion's in a tough spot, man. And it'll be interesting to see how he goes on, and if Daenerys questions his loyalties again, to actually watch their destruction, that's some heavy-duty stuff, man.
Yeah.
You can expect some good performances from Dinklage, I would think, in the coming weeks.
Hold on, this just also, wait real quick, if you've been a follower of the Princes That Were Promised, you know, we do like to talk about our other interest in folklore and myth and science fiction. Billy Laura will inherit $6.8 million from Carrie Fisher's estate. You really think she made more money than that, no?
Oh, dude, it all went up her nose, bro. She definitely did.
You said it, not me.
Being haunted by the ghost of Carrie Fisher. And she's fucking pissed. All right, our final segment for tonight for the Seven Pointed Star. Focusing on Arya, Sansa, and Bran. John, who would you say had the toughest road back to Winterfell?
I'm going to say Arya.
Okay, why?
Every time she tried to get up north, Sully always stopped her from doing it.
She's had a tutor or somebody accompanying her for most of the time. And more often than not, it was someone who was protecting her in a way. And that would be my argument against Arya. And my argument against Bran would be the same thing. He had a group of people who basically all died for him. Just to get him to some fucking, you know, old man living in a tree. And I know you don't like Sansa, and you've made me not like Sansa a lot too, but I think she's had the most difficult road, totally brought on by herself. She did it to herself.
In my point of view, her road has not been as difficult as
it. Oh, I love it. Who's most changed from when they left Winterfell of those three Stark kids? Who's changed the most?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I think all of the change is just, I mean, I feel like Arya is just going to be a lot darker. She's going to be a lot darker, right?
And she's already a lot darker, yeah.
So is Sansa a little bit.
Yeah.
And Bran is just...
Jesus.
Bran is just...
Dude, they could probably dye Brienne's hair dark and pass her off as Bran for an episode. Imagine that.
Let's say the ball change. I'm not sure who the most one. I think it's arguable. You know, which one's changed the most.
The difficult roads that they've all had, they've all now returned to Westeros. They've all now returned to Winterfell, and they're all really good at a certain thing. Arya is apparently an amazing fighter, but she has a really amazing set of skills. Sansa is a pretty good politician, and I think better than we're even being led to believe she is at the moment. And Bran is now the Three-Eyed Raven. So they all leave Winterfell. Sansa and Arya weren't really forced to leave Winterfell, but they all had to leave their home, and they all journey back. It's like they all have a certain skill set that is going to help House Stark to survive the coming battle. And something that I've been trying to figure out is how Arya plays into the Battle for the Dawn, and how Sansa plays into the Battle for the Dawn. And it's kind of easy to see how Bran might, but the two girls, Sansa in particular, I don't see her leaving Winterfell for the rest of the series, right?
I don't think so, no. I don't think so. And there's a, so she says later on this season, that kind of proves that too.
Right.
A little bit. But she might have to, though. If they attack Winterfell, she might have to.
Whenever I thought about the others coming into Westeros, I've never thought of Winterfell being destroyed. I never saw this as a battle that goes all the way south. I always saw it as something that gets fought in the north and won in the north. Maybe I'm wrong, but I just never saw it as something where the Starks have to keep falling back, what's left of the Starks have to keep falling back further and further south. I think what's going to be really interesting, and I hope that they give it enough time, because there's going to be a lot of exciting things happening, a lot of storylines coming to a head, coming into conflict with other storylines, meeting up with other storylines. I hope they give enough attention to how these Stark kids mend their relationship. How these Stark kids come together so the pack survives, right? The lone wolf dies, the pack survives. How these guys come together to make sure that House Stark survives what's coming. I don't even want to use the word family because it feels like it's a silly word to say at this point. Because it's like they don't know each other anymore. Any of them. They may come together as a means of survival, as a means of being victorious over whatever enemies encircle them at this point in time. But that family aspect, that feeling you got in the pilot episode where Catelyn and Ned are watching the boys shoot arrows and Arya sneaks down there. Just family feel you got in that first episode. I don't think we ever see that again. And if we do, maybe it's through the eyes of Sansa with her own family a few years from now. But between Arya, Bran, Sansa, that doesn't return, I don't think. I wouldn't think. I think they're all too far. Their journeys have taken them too far into the darkness for them to ever be able to get that feeling of home that they once had. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd even go so far as to say that, yeah, they're all back at Winterfell, and I'm sure they're all relieved to be there. There's no way it's the feeling, they're feeling what they thought they would. It has to be somewhat disappointing, somewhat of a letdown for them. They've all been trying to get home, and I'm sure they're finding that now that they are at home, their problems are still there.
Yeah, it's like Sansa and Arya, they haven't really forgiven each other.
No.
And
they don't even seem like they trust each other.
Yeah, definitely no.
And Bran is so preoccupied with seeing Jon, because Bran has a bigger mission, something more important that he knows is coming. Without spoilers, Bran, Arya, Sansa, where are their storylines going from Winterfell? I mean, Bran, obviously, he has a bigger picture, a bigger mission. Can he fight that from Winterfell? Do you think he needs to leave Winterfell in order to fight that?
Well, I think he's eventually going to leave Winterfell. I think he's going to go to the God's Eye.
Okay. All right, that makes sense. Well, Arya and Sansa, we just said Sansa probably doesn't leave Winterfell again. What reason is there for her to leave Winterfell? But Arya, if she can fight the way she's fighting, why doesn't she go with Jon beyond the wall?
Yeah, totally, Jon, I got this.
Yeah, I got you guys stay here. I got this for sure. Just need needle. But in all seriousness, do you, I mean, I guess it'd be a spoiler if you told me, but if you didn't know spoiler, would you think that Arya is going to be like on the front lines?
No, I can't say on the front lines, no. That's just, if that happens, that's just D&D just being completely abusive.
Yeah. May as well put Tyrion on the front line too. That's another reunion I'm looking forward to is Tyrion and Sansa.
Yeah.
All right, John, I got a couple quick questions for you, and then we'll take a look at, unless you got something else to say about the Stark kids. And then we'll take give us a look at next week's episode. Answer these questions as quick as possible. Five questions for you.
All right.
Based on characters alive right now, and it could be anybody in any position, who would you make the Warden of the North if it can't be Jon Snow?
I guess go Wardeness of the North, I guess. I don't know. Sansa.
All right.
I mean, it's got to be a Stark, right?
And it can't be Arya, right?
It's... Right. And Bran's going to be...
Yeah.
It's something really funny. Bran's going to be hugging trees in the woods.
All right, come on, guys. We're going to go visit your Uncle Bran. Oh, boy, he's so fucking weird, though. I saw him humping the tree one time. That's not possible. He can't move his legs. That's not possible. I won't say that about your Uncle Bran. All right. Can you give me a Warden of the South?
Ooh. Samwell Tarly.
Nice, dude. Nice. Very good. Give me a Warden of the West if you can.
Jaime Lannister.
And a Warden of the East.
Boy. God, there's no one in the East.
Well, I mean, the current is young master Robert Arryn. But
yeah. My first duty would be to assassinate him.
Yeah.
Throw him down the roof. And the Stormlands, we consider the South, huh?
Stormlands is considered the South, yep. The answer's right there, bro. I mean, for me, much as you hate the character.
It can't be Littlefinger.
That's the only person I could think of, man.
No, it's not Littlefinger. Done. He's done. He's dead. He's going to die. There's no way he lives.
Yeah, no, there's no way he lives.
There's no way, like... Because if you're following my presence of who I'm putting these warrior positions, it's all based on Jon being king. So That's why Samwell will be the South. There's no way he's going to put Littlefinger on the East. I don't know. The East, I might have to.
Oh, maybe, what's his face? Bronze Jon Royce.
Yeah, I guess so. Best bet as anything right now. Unless you're just going to put someone in the East who isn't from the East. He just puts like Gendry there or something.
Well, I mean, Robert was going to do that with Jaime.
Yeah.
All right, maybe this question is a little bit easier for you. But right now, based on people that are alive, based on, let's say Jon Snow's the king, give me the seven members of his Kingsguard, and give me the Lord Commander's name.
The Senate's a lot. It's a lot. Tormund.
Right on, man.
Kingsguard, the Hound.
Right on. I'm with you.
There's got to be some new characters that we don't even know about. Jorah Mormont.
Nice. Although, I think he may be better fitted to be Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, but...
Yeah, that's true. We talked about that.
We'll put him with a question mark for the moment, see if we can come up with somebody better.
There isn't any characters left.
Yeah, right?
There isn't enough characters left to be in seven members.
Maybe this makes it easier. Kingsguard are now allowed... They're allowed to marry, and they don't have to be celibate. They still can't hold lands. I don't know if that even makes it easier.
Well,
it doesn't help.
Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, Jaime Lannister. I'm telling you, I want that line to say to Jaime in regards to John from the books, and to swap it. Fail the father, I shall not fail the son.
Yeah. That'd be a really fucking sick line for him to say. Mm-hmm. He's got to move a little bit in his character where we see that he feels he did fail Rhaegar. Dude, I got six, but I can't come up with a seventh. The Hound, Tormund, Grey Worm, Jaime as Lord Commander, Podrick, Brienne. Hey, listen, man, you know, like I said, slim pickings. I got Jorah with a question mark, and I got Bronn with like three question marks.
I can't think of anyone.
So maybe there's just no more Kingsguard.
There'll just be three of them now.
Yeah.
There's three instead of seven.
These fucking ships are killing me, man. Alright, what's going on next week with Eastwatch? You were talking about it before off air. It sounded like a bit of a filler episode.
Very disappointed with the title. Completely loved Blood of the Dragon a lot better. Because it fit what was going to happen. Because it fits so well what was going to happen with the episode.
Well, it looked like, from the trailer, it looked like they were preparing for... the White Walkers to attack.
Right. Looks like Jon knows that Bran's alive, that Arya's back at Winterfell, that the Night's King, it looks like Jon completely believes that the Night's King is going to Eastwatch, that Bran stole him.
And where's he getting all this information from? I mean, I guess a raven?
Raven, I guess.
It's a lot of information to take a chance with a raven. What if the raven gets shot down or something?
Well, did you see the, I think Bran unleashes like all the ravens in Winterfell.
Oh, wow. All right, that's probably a good idea.
They go north, and that's like that scene from the trailer. And he like Bran walks into all the ravens.
Like, and he can fly the ravens too. Okay, good stuff.
We'll definitely see some very important documents at the Citadel.
Will we?
Hell yeah!
So the audience will get confirmation. Mm-hmm. Will this, John, put to rest?
Never. They'll just say the show's doing it. They'll never admit to it. The books will be different. The show's just placated to the fans. I haven't heard much from the anti-RLJ crowd lately. Anyways, they seem to come out after the seasons, like, you know, when they can like come up with their
full argument.
Yeah,
it's dangerous to come up with the argument during the season because something may happen to totally refute your argument. They got to wait till the season ends when they know they have some time. What are your feelings on George R.R. Martin lately? Have you thought of him at all?
And he was in New York with his publishing.
I purchased a Game of Thrones enhanced edition for my iPhone. I'm not exactly sure why I did it. Something's been making me want to read these books again, but I've also been telling myself, don't, because you'll just be disappointed when you finish, and he's still like nowhere near publication. But then another part of me is saying, I love these fucking books so much and I want to read them again. And I want all that world building that I'm not getting in Game of Thrones. And I also know that once these episodes end, it's going to be a long wait until we get anything. So maybe if I read, it won't be so bad. It was only at $7.99 and I bought it, the enhanced edition. And I read the prologue last night. Some good stuff, bro. Some good stuff. And I don't know if I'm going to get into a total like binge reread, but every couple nights, maybe I read a chapter and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. That being said, what else you got, my friend?
Was there something I was supposed to say tonight that I held off on Sunday?
I know what the battle there was, but...
Oh, God. I forgot.
Maybe it was the Golden Company? Oh, I know something I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. Where's Gendry? I thought we were getting Gendry back this season.
4 more days.
Nice, dude. Nice. He's just going to come rowing up on his boat?
He's going to be someplace. I'm not sure where.
All right, good stuff.
There's going to be some missions going on.
Is he with the Brotherhood Without Banners?
No.
Okay. Are we going to see them next week? Or Sunday, rather?
I imagine. They're going to Eastwatch, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, we got to see them soon.
They're going to get a whole lot of light reunions next week. Captain Frenzo.
Oh, bro, I can't wait for that one. I cannot wait. Listen, man, it was despite what everyone's saying about the spoils of war, it was, for me, it was a bummer of an episode. I know you're not as down on it as I am, but trying to go through this stuff and find some positive things to talk about it's not easy, for me at least. So I'm looking forward to Eastwatch just to kind of cleanse the palate and get back on track. Matt Shackman is again directing next week's episode. Jeremy Podeswa is directing the finale.
Mm-hmm.
He also directed the opening episode. And yes, mm-hmm. Alan Taylor is directing episode 6. So I imagine that's going to be the big battle, is episode 6. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, awesome. Do you think it's going to be balls to the wall for these final 3 episodes?
Well, I think this episode's going to be, you're going to get a lot of the document stuff. That's going to be a big reveal. You're going to get the meetups. You're going to get the chess players in motion. Okay. That's going to happen.
Creating excitement for the final 2 episodes.
Well, it's one of the biggest reveals of all time.
Well, I feel like we already had that reveal. Oh, well, no. Okay. All right. Part 2. The more important part of that reveal.
The episode 7 is going to have, like, I don't know.
Yeah, you were telling me about that. You spoiled it for me, and I like it. I'm into it.
I think it's going to be so epic.
That's awesome, man. But we'll not talk about that on the air. All right, guys. As always, thank you for listening. You can find us at our homepage, thepromisedprinces.actionpackedpodcast.com. Like us on Facebook. Shoot us a message. Check out our new video at facebook.com/thepromisedprinces. Tweet at us. Send us a raven at Princess Promised. You can check out our new Facebook page, which isn't much of anything but a slideshow video right now, but it will be more one day. And that's The Princes That Were Promised on YouTube. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave us a review. We would most appreciate it. And we will speak with you Monday morning, Tuesday morning. We'll speak with you right after Eastwatch airs. And we appreciate it. John, as always, it's been a pleasure. We'll speak with you guys later. Bum 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 b